Well, let's not worry about that just right now. We do have a copy of that.
You have a copy.
We'll do a copy of that. So. What help did the Germans give you in developing the process? I mean, apart from actually being there and working with you, did any sort of great help come over from Germany? I suppose the Mercury process is probably the best example of the technical help that you got from Germany.
Yeah, we got, I went over and I got the information that was necessary, and we built a pilot plant, and it worked. And it's a good thing we didn't build a big plant, because handling mercury is a lousy job.
Yeah. What were the plans, I mean, at the time we're talking of now, you know, 32, 33, so forth, what was the ultimate aim as far as using it in Germany were concerned? I mean, it was in connection with the synthetic rubber work.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no intention to use it for other kinds of acetylene chemistry. I mean, obviously, I know you can't separate the two completely, but it was specifically with the synthetic rubber work in mind.
Well, that was considered the main purpose of the work, but I'm sure the Germans were interested in other uses for acetylene.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, they got into this,
that was a bit late. That was really late. And Standard itself, I mean, what did Standard? Standard was basically interested in the process as far as using synthetic rubber as well.
That was our only interest. We weren't interested in selling acetic acid and all that kind of business.
I think the impression from some historians, and I couldn't tell you who just offhand, but I got the impression from one or two sources that Standard simply developed the art process at Baton Rouge simply to show winning. But they themselves...
To do what?
Well, just as a sign of goodwill, if it were. You know, in other words... But
goodwill. Goodwill for the Germans?
For the Germans, yes. I mean, but it would never any serious. Well, I get the impression, I think Sam Harris to some extent gives the impression, but it would never any serious intention to use the art process in America.
Well,
it would be to give the Germans a favour, you know. Not quite understandable,
well, we reached the point where we recognized that the art process was not the way to make synthetic rubber.
But before that, it was
by 1935, that was pretty clear that that was not the way to do it.
As early as 35.
Yeah. And then, as I mentioned in there, we got off on the dehydrogenation of the porphyrins.
Let's wait on the ground.
Didn't do anything to...
Okay.
To make the Germans feel good, any object there.
Okay, fine. That makes better sense.
Yeah.
What was your impression of Paul Baumann in this period? How did he enjoy his stay in America?
Well, he was one of my very best friends.
Mm-hmm.
Always, ever since I've known him.
Mm-hmm. And did he enjoy?
I taught him how to drive an automobile.
Mm-hmm. Oh, did you? Mm-hmm. But he was one of his differences between America and Germany in that period. If it was a great.
Well, he came over here in 1930, about the time Bella came, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And he lives in this boarding house in Elizabeth, where I live.
Mm-hmm.
And he had his wife and little daughter there. And we got very chummy.
Yeah, yeah.
I taught him how to drive a car then. When I went to Germany in 1933, he went with me. The two of us went to Germany, and I got information on Knapsack and other things too. Baumann was the guy that was conducting me around, and I talked to a lot of the laboratory people. On various new projects that they were working on.
Right. You got free access.
Then I had free access.
Hmm.
There must have been about 10 or 15 different projects.
Right.
And I would talk with the chemist, and Paul Baumann would then write a memorandum to have it on paper so that I would get it straight and I'd take the memorandum back to the chemist.
Mm-hmm.
so that there was no hold up on information at that point.
No, no. Well, perhaps that's also something we can come back to. I was interested when you said in your memoirs that Paul Bauman was interested in chemical engineering in America. And this is very interesting because there's been a great deal of work done lately on the fact that there hasn't really been any development of chemical engineering in Germany, but chemists are supposed to be able to handle the things done here by chemical engineers. Whereas you yourself have just come from one of the great centres of chemical engineering. Yes. Did you sort of perceive that difference at the time?
Yeah, it was 100% different.
But
they really didn't have any chemical engineers.
That's right. Well, even now, I think
they did things by cut and try.
That's right. Mm. Do you think that that was a great weakness on the part of the German chemical industry?
Well, it probably was, but they got along all right.
Mm. But you feel that probably had that
happened? See, when I saw some of the plants that made soda ash, for example.
Yeah.
I just worked for Allied Chemical on the biggest soda ash plant in the world, you know.
Mm.
What the Germans had was kind of childish.
It was childish, yeah.
Mm.
Mm. I mean, when you were in Germany, did you get the feeling that the engineering was sometimes troubled? You know, was not up to the same high standard you would have expected at Baton Rouge or...
Well, I think they were pretty good with machinery, I think, compressors, compressors and all that stuff.
But perhaps that's an indication of the fact they were done by mechanical engineers. The things that were done by mechanical engineers
were fine,
and the things that were done by chemists were fine, but the indefinable something in the middle wasn't so good.
Well, Bauman was very interested to see how we did the engineering, and he sat with me and observe what I did when I designed the equipment for the aldehyde plant and the acetic acid plant.
Mm.
I designed the equipment completely, even the heat exchangers I designed.
Mm.
I think the German chemists used to downrate the engineers. I've heard them do it in the plant.
Mm. But we're almost up to a point we can draw with your general interest. But let me just ask two other quick questions. The first thing is, in your memoirs, Mr. Green, you say that the arc, the actual arc itself, is the temperature of the sun. Well,
5,000 degrees is what the Germans say. 5,000 degrees centigrade.
Yeah, but I think that's a bit lower than the temperature of the sun.
No, and the surface is about 5,000 degrees, maybe 6,000. Inside, of course, is 95. I don't know how many thousands degrees it is.
But we're talking about the temperature we're talking about is 5,000 at any rate.
Yeah,
fine. And how do you think that the arc process compared with other forms of porosity? Hydrocarbons, like the Ruhr chemi. Wasn't it the Ruhr chemi process where you have the fabric regeneration of fabric?
We looked at some of those in later years.
Yeah.
And the Wolf process.
And the Wolf process is what I was thinking.
Yeah. And the Wolf process, I don't know whether it's still used.
I think it's dying out. What about the Tachesh process? The Tachesh process, where you have actual burning of hydrocarbon in situ. I mean, the BASF process.
Mm-hmm. You mean with oxygen burning hydrocarbon?
Mm.
I don't know.
But, of course, one interesting thing I could perhaps say is that I visited the German, at all. When was it? 1980. And the interesting thing was that the arcs are still the same arc. The equipment in the arc house is still the same equipment that was installed in 1940.
Were they running the arc?
They were running the arc.
In 1980 they were running it?
Oh yeah, they were still using them now.
Where was that?
Sure. But the equipment was vintage 1940. I mean, there was a great deal of Bakelite on display that you wouldn't expect in the modern times. And the equipment was massive. no question of militarization. The main thing I noticed was just the tremendous noise of all these. There was a great deal of knocking. No, a great deal of knocking noise.
And the compressor compressed,
isn't it? I wouldn't have to pin it down, but it was certainly the noise in the art house itself was tremendous.
I guess there was a noise, but I...
Of course, you've got to remember there will be about 12 going at once.
Yes, yeah.
In this case. Yeah, but I know they had this particular one which they had altered, so they could open it and show you the art inside.
Yeah.
Now, perhaps I could just simply ask a general question at this point about your impression. I know this is a very big question, but your impression about the IG Farben plant and the thing that the Ludwig Farben Laboratory, which I know impressed Frank Howard so much when he saw them in 1946. I mean, just feel free to sort of...
It's a fascinating place, as you know. The way they worked there was different from the way we worked.
No, that's interesting. More
they would have little teams working on projects. Bauman had, he had four engineers working under him, and he had more, but working on the dark process. And Deller and his crew was working on the oxidation of paraffin wax. But then they also had groups working in competition with each other, objective, but working out different processes.
Now this is a very interesting point, because there was a study made about 15 years ago in Britain, which tried to claim that there was this deliberate policy of competition between laboratories. In other words, at any one time, two laboratories would be working on competitive processes. And now, I find that interesting, because in my own work, I tended to feel that a lot of this competition arose not through some great scheme to have this competition between laboratories, but just simply due to the fact that if Ludwig Harmon was asked to do some work on synthetic rubber, Leverkusen would say, hang on, we've been doing that for 10 years, we're not going to give up our work on that. So they would say, okay, you carry on with that and we'll see how you get on. To me, a lot of this competition, although obviously it was competition, was really an attempt to classify established interest in each of the laboratories rather than some great master plan.
Well, I guess so, but I was thinking that within the Opal laboratory there was competition between groups.
Even within the laboratory?
Yeah, within the same laboratory, yeah.
I see, but that would be...
And they knew that the people working in the group knew it, and it didn't bother them, they were good friends.
Today, can you give a specific example of that? That would be very interesting.
Well, I was trying to think. Well, on the acid aldehyde example, I was told that somebody that kept files on that, and I don't have the files, but they were working on a method using zinc chloride as a catalyst to convert acetylene to acid aldehyde.
Okay.
That's a certain kind of catalyst, I forget what you call it.
Well, zinc chloride to make acetylene to acid aldehyde.
Acetylene and water.
And
zinc chloride.
Funny enough,
that was supposed to compete with this solid catalyst.
Well, I can give you an example. In Opal, there was a Dr. Müller Conradi, who had a little group working for him, and they came up with the polymerization of isobutylene to make a polymer known as polyisobutylene or
It had other names later, and when Mr. Howard was on one of his visits, they showed him a sample of it.
Oh, I did, yeah.
But here was a separate little group working on this thing. And the, one of the reasons they did this, you know, they were very anxious to get the patents in their own name.
Right.
There was a competition for patents and recognition in IG that was very important.
That wasn't the case in Echo.
Well, we had people who were competing to get patents, all right, sure, but
not in the
it, it was a little different because they got sort of remuneration, you know, for their achievement. Mm. They got a share, they got some kind of a little share in the results of the process.
In Germany?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, you've raised two interesting points there, which I would like to deal with just briefly. The first of which concerns the patenting of isobutylene, because I've read in Howard and elsewhere that Muro Kumradi and his group achieved that, I think, in the spring of 1932. Oh no, it must have been even earlier than that. When did they first polymerize isobutylene? That must have been about 27 in fact.
It must have been earlier than 1932, because I think we had a pilot plant to develop the process here at Linden, you know.
It might have been much earlier than that. But the thing was that someone was asking me about this, so he could put it in a picture upon him a town, Herbert Marvick. I don't know if you want to come across him. Anyway, I brought this point up with him, and he asked me for the patent. Which is very reasonable. Yeah. But when I went to Chemical Abstract, the earliest patent I could find was about 10 years later, it was about 1936.
And well, it only takes time to get the patent issued, you know.
Well, I'm talking about years. But 10 year gap there seems
well.
Anyway, there's one other point.
What is your point on the.
Still money, of course, because the battery is in it. Well, the other thing I wanted to ask about Muro Kumradi, because did you ever know him well?
I knew him quite well.
You did know him quite well. But he's a bit of a mystery character, because...
I took him to Baytown, Texas once, on a trip. You weren't there.
No, I wasn't there.
But it was very interesting, and he was a very nice guy.
What kind of person was he? I mean, what was his position in the IG, for example?
Well, I really
hard to tell. He had an elevated position, but you couldn't exactly tell where it was.
That's not. He's one of the strange things about him. There's two strange things about him I found. Firstly, is that although he was very important, I mean, he had quite a lot to do with the synthetic rubber program in the IG. I mean, if you look at minutes of a rubber conference, or even patents, that he had clearly an important but sort of elevated position. I say elevated in the sense that I suspect a lot of the patents for which he is quoted as co-inventor, he was just simply the group leader. Not the real inventor. But anyway, leaving that aside, if you talk to the German developers or look at the German history that we've got here, you will find him very much downgraded. I mean, you know, he's mentioned only when necessary, like, for example, giving the co-inventor of a patent. You won't find him touted as a prime mover.
He was not really the inventor of this polyisobutylene.
It
seemed to me he must have been reasonably important. He made a special trip down to Baytown, Texas, and I took him down there.
Right.
And the chief engineer of Humble, Ernie Voss, and I took care of him, and Ernie showed him all over the Humble plant, showed him everything. And he didn't go for any special reason, as far as I could see.
No.
Just wanted to get a general idea of the way we do things in the oil industry,
But the thing, anyway, the strange thing was that he died in 1945.
Oh, he did?
And I've never been able to find out, I know this kind of funny thing to say, but I've never been able to find out how he died. Would made me wonder whether it could have been true at that point, given his age. But the other strange thing is that he is downgraded. I mean, there is a definite unwillingness. I mean, I've said to people, I mean, one of the first things I thought of when I went to Germany is I've got to find out more about this person. I mean, I knew quite a lot about some other people, including some which might be regarded, in inverted commas, as disreputable. But I never ever heard anything about him, and everybody, and when I mentioned it to people of that generation in Germany, they always said, ho-hum, he wasn't terribly important, let's move on to something else quickly.
Yeah.
but the other thing is that why I really wanted to know more about him was that between 33 and 34, and 33-34, he was this connection, he was the sort of avenue of communication, if you like, between the company and the government as regarding synthetic rubber.
So was it?
He was the one who wrote the letters. I mean, I'm just saying, he was the one who wrote the letters. Now, that seems curious for someone who was in charge of an ammonia laboratory. Especially, okay, I know the ammonia laboratory had a lot to do with synthetic rubber, but nevertheless, even within the IG Farben framework, he seems far from being the obvious person.
Well, where was he located? At Opal?
At Opal, yeah.
But the synthetic rubber was Leverkusen.
Oh, quite. I mean,
project.
Opal had a bit to do with it. It wasn't the most major bit for all.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Opal did have a bit to do. I mean,
Dr. Ambrose was quite important on the synthetic rubber, and he was around Ludwigshafen with us when I was there.
Oh, quite, quite. Mm-hmm. In fact, Dr. Ambrose is someone I want to speak about in a moment.
I'm sure he does.
Well, for one thing, but in 33, of course, he wasn't that important yet. It was really sort of 34, 35.
No, he wasn't quite that important. No, but he was an important man. I could tell that.
Yeah.
I went out with him socially, with a number of people there.
Yeah. Well, of course, he was somebody who refused to meet me.
And that was, what year was that? Well, I was living in Germany in 31 and 32.
In 32. Mm-hmm.
I see.
The one story I heard about him in Germany was that he got on with, you know, he rose to rapid prominence. Of course, he was the youngest director of the IG Farben when it ended in 1945. He owed his rise to power to the fact that he married the daughter of the factory chief of Ludwigshafen.
Yeah. The reason I brought up Müller Conradi and the polyisobutylene was that, you know, that really led to, helped us inspire our people to make butyl rubber.
Oh, quite. Okay. Yeah,
okay.
Well, in fact, we could mention that briefly, because, of course, the Germans made the great failure, from their point of view, of never introducing a diene.
Yeah.
Now, there's two questions there. The first question is, why do you think they failed to do that?
Because they're interested in GRF.
I see, right.
GRF. That was their life. They weren't interested in butyl rubber.
Even when it came along.
Yeah. In 1938, Premier came over.
Yeah.
He was their big synthetic rubber man.
Yeah.
Right.
He was a big came man. Over, and I think Russell talked to him about, well, I was in the same meeting, and butyl rubber was mentioned.
Yes.
But he didn't have any interest in butyl rubber at all.
Incidentally, I may say in parentheses, but I gather Shamir was very fond of America.
He was.
Very pro-American, I gather. But anyway, that's an aside. Now, were the Germans offered butyl? I mean, were they offered the formula of butyl? But of course, this is one of the sore points in the whole question of whether standard helped, I agree or not. I have something comforting to say about that point, but were they actually offered the formula for butyl rubber?
Well, did you read, Mr. Howard's book?
Yeah.
He talks about it in there, doesn't he?
Yes, but my memory now is...
What did he say?
Not exactly about.
I thought he answered at one of the meetings.
But they weren't very interested.
They weren't interested.
Well, I can state categorically, having studied the German record, but they never used it. And the reason why I'm making this is because it's one of the four things which Dan did it all accused of in helping the Germans.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that the blue towel was never of any... The only thing they knew Polly Peter dying for was, as you say in your memoir, an additive to things like polyethylene and stuff like that.
Polybutylene.
Which one do you mean? Polybutylene. Yeah. That's right. Well, I mean, they did use it, but only for a very small... But that's not like a rubber. The point is that that's not butyl rubber. That is non-dyeing additive. But had an interesting process for making it, as you probably know, because they chilled, they mixed it, as I think you did, with liquid ethylene. And then they use the evaporation of the liquid ethylene to cool it down to the right temperature. And as it was evaporating, it flowed onto a cold, well, I should say, from its point of view, a hot plate, but from point of view of the engineer, the cold plate.
Well, it was ethane they mixed it with, I think.
Yeah, was it?
Rather than ethylene.
And then there was a crater that went along, breaking it off.
A peculiar apparatus.
That's right,
yeah.
But it only made a very small amount, I think something like 1,000 tons a year.
Well, you know, one theory is that the reason Mr. Howard offered them Duna rubber is to try to get them to move on Duna rubber.
Oh, that's quite fine.
Yeah.
But, I don't know if we're going to have time for that now, but that was a point we could perhaps come back to. I'm still trying to get some idea. I mean, I've already got a very good idea of what the IG research effort was like, but what were the attitudes of the people working in that research effort? I mean, was their attitude very much one of, shall we say, academic researchers transported to an industrial location, or were they very hard-headed about the truth of their research? I'm talking of the sort of people at the...
Well, they were
the bench, as it were.
Well, they were very interested in making a success of their work, of course.
Yeah. Mm.
But I went over there in 1933 for several months.
Somebody at the door. Well, I guess he's delivering them at the mail.
Money?
Money?
22.
He went over in 33.
Yeah, Hitler had been in a year
when
I was there. But the chemists I was in contact with were anti-Hitler.
But what about...
They were pretty frank about it to me.
Interesting. But what about... But the people you're talking about are, I suppose, what you might call relatively low-level people. I mean, can you give a specific name of someone? I suppose Paul Bowman would be a case in point. Can you name anyone else of that same level? Who was working on synthetic rubber, for example, who had this tank and the Nazi attitude?
Well, Hans Beller.
Right.
Did you ever hear of Beller?
Yeah.
He was involved in the Paris and oxidation.
Right. But what about the attitude of various higher ups in the company?
Well,
I'm thinking of not so much the senior, you know, the very senior people, but people like Ambrose, who then went on.
Who was the head of the laboratory there?
And just to shift over to the lab where I was, Dr. Peer was the head of the hydrogenation laboratory where I was.
Dr.
Peer.
P-I-P-R.
He was the top expert on hydrogenation.
Hmm.
And they're doing a lot of hydrogenation work of coal and oil there in that those laboratories. And I had the feeling from discussions with him that he didn't care for the Nazis.
Despite the field and working in the world.
Yeah, but some of his assistants, like Dr. Ringer, you probably read about Dr. Ringer, Christopher Ringer, he turned out to be a very pro-Nazi before he got through.
Oh, I see.